Welcome back to the Positive View of Rural podcast. We're talking to all kinds of people from all over who have a positive view of the future of rural. So, Rick, tell us who you are and where you live.
My name is Rick Skorupski. I live on the northern high plains of South Dakota, on the eastern half of the state. The town that I'm attached to is called Frankfort, but it's 17 miles away, and the only thing I see from that town is the mailman.
And so how big is that town?
I think it's got a population of about 80.
Okay, and so where is your commerce center? Where do you go when you need to buy groceries?
I go down south to Huron, which is the county seat of the county south of me, or I will go north to Redfield, which is my county seat.
Okay. So that'll help. All the people that are local to you now are nodding their heads. They know where that is exactly.
Right, right. Well, you know you live in rural South Dakota when you have to mention four different towns before people figure out where you're from.
I have a friend he's in Alabama, and he gives his description he has a succeeding series of smaller and smaller towns. And if you know where that one's from, then he'll give you a smaller town name. And he does that until he gets to his little town of, like, I don't remember, 50 people. That's his nearby town. And he still does, like you, he doesn't live in that town. But I think rural people can identify with that. We have to kind of narrow down the place we're from based on what we think the other person might know of our area.
Exactly.
So tell us why you are positive about rural.
When I was in the Navy, I had a good friend of mine who was senior to me, and he introduced me and told me about rural Iowa. And then he retired, and when I transferred from the West Coast to the East Coast, I stopped and visited him in rural Iowa. And I fell in love with it. Now, I'm a city boy, or a suburban boy anyway. Raised in New Jersey, but he at the time was selling a particular hog supplement that required him to go from farm to farm to farm to peddle his wares. So I spent 3 days with him in his little Ford Ranger pickup truck going from farm to farm to farm around Iowa, talking to people and learning things. And he was a great teacher. He would point things out and explain why things were so. And I just fell in love with the culture. It's a culture that I remember when I was a young boy. One of the things that I've talked to the powers that be in South Dakota about, I keep telling them they should change their billboard. When you come into the state on the interstate, it should say, "Welcome to South Dakota. June Cleaver still lives here." The culture that is here in Middle America is a culture that I grew up with as a small boy in the 50s and 60s. And I missed it, and I didn't realize it still existed, but it does here. There's a respect of persons here. There's a respect of property here. There is an honesty that abounds, is the only way I can say it. People are, you don't have to look for the straight shooter. You actually have to look for the guy that's the crook, and I kind of like that.
So you feel like our culture, as an outsider, I mean, you have a very valuable viewpoint, and you feel like really it's the culture and the people and the way that we're raised here that turns out to be our best asset.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So I'm sorry, go ahead. Right ahead.
No, that's all right. Go ahead.
Well, tell me how you picked your rural place. I mean, so you went and you toured Iowa Hog Farms. Is not exactly where you ended up there in South Dakota. How did you choose the place you ended up?
Well, I was in the People's Republic of New Jersey, and I decided I needed to get out. I mean, I was working somewhere around 60 hours a week. My wife was working about 40 hours a week, and once we took out our pencil and we looked at it, we realized that we were working almost two-thirds of that just for the privilege of living in New Jersey. And it's crowded. It's overcrowded. It's busy. The people are not friendly. The traffic is a mess. There was nothing good about it other than some family members I had around me. I wanted to get out, and then I remembered visiting my friend Don in Iowa and rural, and I started looking for property around Iowa, needless to say. Our original plan was to get the big RV and snowbird and have a house in one place and just travel south when it got cold. Well, Iowa was too expensive. I moved over and looked at Nebraska. That was too expensive. So I took a step north. And I got looking around up here, and I found that I could afford a house in South Dakota and still snowbird and retire, you know, use my Navy pension and retire. So that's what led me in this direction. And it's a much longer story, more than you want to hear on an interview, as to why I picked the house that I did. But it was just one of those things that it miraculously appeared on the day that I was looking for it. So that was fun, too. But we wound up here. My property, it's a small property as South Dakota goes. It's huge by New Jersey standards. It's a little over 17 acres. And I paid about 15 cents on the dollar from the house that I sold in New Jersey that was on a postage stamp.
That's the magic of getting out away from the crowded real estate market, is that you suddenly find your dollar goes a lot further on housing. And food,
automobile insurance, and fees, and taxes, and everything else. When I was in New Jersey, I was paying almost $8,000 a year in taxes, on property taxes, on a little 1,200-foot, four-bedroom house. Out here, I've got 17 acres, 2,500 foot, and four outbuildings, and I'm paying less than 10% of it.
I'm feeling a little better about my Oklahoma property taxes now. They're nothing like those city property taxes. So, you know, and I think that those kind of things, you said, you know, your house just appeared at the right time and just was just the right day for you to find it. Those things kind of just happen in a lot of small towns. I think there's a lot of serendipity that goes on in rural areas that we don't give it credit for. And I don't know what causes that magic. I just know that it's there.
Well, I blame the man upstairs, but you know, everybody has their own opinion about that.
So tell me about you. You've retired from the military.
I retired from the Navy in 1993. I went into the recreational boating business as a parts guy. And I did that because I owned a boat, and I figured I pretty much knew my way around a boat. So I got a job in a parts department at a marina and immediately learned how much I didn't know. But the gentleman that hired me as entry level, which I could afford to do because I was retired Navy. And I learned. And over a course of 10 years, I became the second highest paid parts guy in the state of New Jersey. And the reason I know I was the second is because I was good friends with the guy that was the first. And we were doing well. We were making good money. But all I'm doing, I've got a six-figure income, and I'm just making ends meet. And I'd had enough. And it was time to get out. And that's when I started looking. As I said, we intended to get the big RV and snowbird. Well, we got up here, we got settled in March, and by the time we got to August, I knew I wasn't going anywhere. I love it here. I'm not going anywhere. We never did buy the big RV. Instead, I bought something to push snow and a four-wheel drive pickup truck.
That'll help you fit right in. There's the four-wheel drive right there. So you do multiple things now to make a living there.
Well, I have off and on done several different things. And again, like I say, I'm retired. I'm living on my Navy paycheck, and on my tag on my email, I put down because I can. It's not a whole lot of money, but then again, I don't have big car payments. I'm living on the cheap because I want to. But in the meantime, I will help with the harvest every year. I have my commercial driver's license, so I drive some semi for a time. You know, I'll drive semi during the year to help Paul bring to the elevators. I have worked as a farm hand a couple of years because of a neighbor that, he just needed help. He needed an extra body, and I was handy. Why not? I haven't done that before. Let me go learn what this is about. So, yeah, I've done several different things. I've gotten involved in a couple of volunteer boards. One is called Grow Spink, which is the Economic Development Board for the county that I'm in. So I've done a number of different things, but they're all fun. My wife and I are pickers. We'll go to auctions, and we'll pick up things that we can flip on eBay or on Etsy, and we turn that for a dollar. Yeah, we're retired, but we don't allow ourselves to get bored. Then I turned around. I realized I love this place so much, I wrote a book. And I had a real lot of fun with that. In fact, when you called, I was in the middle of editing my second book. But I wrote a book called Flyover County, not country, but county. It's a play on words. And I wrote a story that is fiction And it's a story of mommy, daddy, and two kids who moved from a town near Baltimore, and I don't say what state they're in because I wanted to keep my artistic license, to a town that I imagineered up called Helen, South Dakota. And people ask me, why Helen? Well, South Dakota has a Hazel and they have a Henry, so I figured I might as well have a Helen. But the whole story is these people moving to from the East Coast into Middle America, into a tiny town of 300, and the culture shock that follows. And I had a ball writing it, and I have yet to have anybody read it that tell me that they didn't enjoy it. So that's my plug. Now we can go to your next question.
Well, let's talk about the book, because I find it interesting. You did a more of a lighthearted story. I mean, it's a friendly story, as opposed to, I know another gentleman who's writing a small town book, but he's writing a murder mystery. And so that's a completely different tone than your book is.
Well, no. And what I did is I took the stories things that happened to me, things that I'd heard happen to other people, stories that other people told, and I lumped it all into these poor four people and had it all happen to them. But nice things. For instance, when we got here, we moved in, and about a week and a half or 2 weeks later, the gentleman who sold me the property, who still farms around me because I bought his farmstead, he said, we'd like to have a housewarming party for you. And I'm thinking, gee whiz, I'm wall-to-wall boxes. What am I going to do with this? And he said, don't worry about that. People know you've just moved in. He said, and don't worry about a thing. We'll bring everything. We'll take care of everything. We'll clean up. You won't even know we're here once we're gone. So we, of course, said yes, because we want to meet our neighbors. And we had a house full of people, and we had a wonderful evening chatting and learning people's names and figuring out who was who. They were nice enough to each wear a name tag, which kind of helped us a lot. But they didn't lie. When they left, we didn't know that they had been there. All the dishes are gone. Everything was cleaned in the sink and put away. They even took the trash with them. And that I put into the book.
I love it. I think that every town has some stories like this. Every small town has some stories like this, that it would be so much fun to make one compilation. And what if they all happened to the same group of people? I see where you're going with it.
Exactly.
So why did you decide to do a book? Were you a writer before? Is this something that was new for you?
I've always wanted to write a book. I've tried a few different times. I couldn't get the kind of traction that I needed. I'd start a story, but I couldn't figure out where it was going. Or I didn't know enough about the plot line to be able to write with any kind of authority. So it would come off phony and people wouldn't like it. But I learned a long time ago that if you want to write about something, you've got to write about what you know and you've got to write about what you love. So the passion comes through. And that's what I did. And that's what I'm still doing. Like I said, I finished the second book. I'm in the edit phase and I've already started writing my third. I love it here. And my wife loves it here. For the first 2 years, we copied the Walgreens commercial and called it the Land of Perfect. It's just, my nearest neighbor's a mile and a quarter away. All of these things they're little pluses that I'm not used to from being crowded and congested on the East Coast. The people are outrageously friendly and helpful. We had an ice storm up here in 2005. We've been here about a year and a half. And we had an ice storm that took out power for 8 days. And everybody pulled together. Everybody made sure that everybody was okay. The phones were still working, but the power was out because the phones were underground. But everybody, I was getting calls from people 20 miles away. Rick, you doing okay? You're not used to this stuff. What they didn't realize is in New Jersey, I lost power at least for 5 or 6 hours once a month. So I had kerosene lamps, and I had kerosene heaters, and I had all different kinds of backup systems for what I needed to do. I was actually more prepared than some of my neighbors. I got out in my pickup truck and I brought my pastor and a spare kerosene heater, and I split half of the kerosene I had with him. And then I found out another neighbor had a 30-gallon barrel of kerosene that he wasn't using, so we split that between myself and the pastor because we were the only two running kerosene heaters. Just those kind of things. It was just a wonderful thing. I want to go back a bit and talk about here. The economy of the Midwest, the economy especially up in here in South Dakota, was what brought me here. The people is what got me to stay. The people is what got me to fall in love with it. To walk into a store and have the lady say, oh, no, we don't take credit cards, but we'll take your check. And they've never met me before was something that's a culture shock. It's something I'm not used to. Because you get on the East Coast, they don't even want to hear about your check. But they'll take your credit card.
So if somebody had asked you, say, 5 years before you moved or before you had toured Iowa, would it have ever occurred to you that you could feel at home in a rural area?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Like I said, I'm a city boy. When I retired out of the Navy, I'd already been introduced to Iowa, but I moved back to New Jersey because at that time my passion was boats and the things and the New Jersey shore and the things that go on with that. But even at that point, you know, I was not happy with New Jersey, but I didn't know any better because I'd only lived in major, not necessarily cities, but in major suburbia. So without my friend Don introducing me to rural Iowa, no, I never would have considered it. And even moving out here, I didn't realize, just to show you my ignorance, when we moved out here, we came out here in September to look at the house to decide whether or not we were going to buy it. And we had heard about this drought that was going on here and in Iowa. And I'm driving out, it's late September, and I'm seeing all of this corn in the field that's standing, that's brown. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, these poor farmers, they've lost all of those crops. I never knew before corn had to finish out before you could combine it. I didn't learn that until after I got here. I thought all these farmers had gone broke.
That's the way it is. We hear some of that about wheat. We've got a lot of wheat crop in this area. And so the wheat is green through the winter because they grow winter wheat here. And then it has to die and the heads have to turn before it's time to harvest. And this does confuse people who are not from the area as to why they let that wheat go that long, you know, why it's all dead before they harvest it.
Well, I was the same way.
It's one of those things you've got to learn. You know, these are things that are new when you don't grow up in an area. So you serve on your local economic development board, your county board. What makes you, I mean, besides people who just retire into the area and find it through serendipity, what gives your area a future? What makes your area have something in its future?
Well, this is something I've been working on. I actually wrote an article for a magazine up here that's distributed through the newspapers called Dakota Fire, and I love this magazine. And the lady, give me one second. I just got to kill this phone call.
Oh my God.
Got nothing, Leonard. I'm on a long distance call. Got to go. There we go. That was my, believe it or not, that's my mailman to see if I have any packages to send out.
From his cell phone,
he calls me every day because we have packages that we send out from eBay, for eBay and for Etsy and things. And he'll call to see if he needs to stop by. Welcome to rural America.
You bet.
Yeah, so I'm sorry for the interruption, but it gave me a chance to tell another story.
Yeah.
But where was I going?
Telling us about the future of rural, the future of your area. You have written a little article for Dakota Fire.
Yeah, Dakota Fire magazine, and I love this magazine because its entire purpose in life is to try to get young people to stay rural. And I think that's worth any time and attention I can give to it. But I did a study up here, and I did it. It's in the Dakota Fire range, which is the James River Valley, which basically goes from the part of southern central North Dakota down through the James River Valley, which is where I am, the eastern half of South Dakota, and down to the Nebraska border. And it's all rural. There are only a couple of larger towns, and by larger towns I mean 12,000, along this whole route. But I did a study. Everybody bemoans the shrinking population of rural America. Well, I'm very happy to say that that's no longer the case. It has switched. The population has bottomed and is starting to flatten out and starting to grow in rural towns and small towns. I have a town near me called Northville. It's about 120 people. It built 6 houses in the last 2 years. And that's more than they've built in the last 40 years. It's switching. And why is it switching? It's switching because of exactly what you and I are doing right now. I'm sitting in a house that's, 30 miles from the nearest population center of 12,000 people. And I'm talking to you on the internet, and I don't know how far you are away from any major town. But I'm using something that wasn't here 20 years ago. You see, people are moving from urban to rural because they like a school that only has 100 kids in it. But at the same time, they can bring their job with them. They're working on the internet. They're working. They're doing consulting work. They're working from home. Businesses are coming out here now because they have the infrastructure, electronic infrastructure, they need to make things work. That's why I'm seeing it turn the corner. That's why I'm seeing it grow. The people are fed up on both coasts, east and west, with the obtrusiveness of the population and the government that, that controls it. They want to get out, but they're finding out now because of the internet that there is a place to get out too. So all of a sudden, what you're seeing and what I'm seeing is all of these little towns around me are suddenly having housing shortages, where for years there was a glut, and houses would go to seed, and they would have to tear them down. And well, now all of a sudden, I sat on the phone one afternoon, and I called, I guess about 50 different rural post offices, and these are towns of not more than, say, 400 people. And I called, and I asked for the postmaster or postmistress, whichever it happened to be. But I asked for the postmaster, and I said, if I were to walk into your post office today and ask you if you knew of a house for rent, could you name more than one? And many of them said, no, I couldn't even name one. And you look at the school populations, and you look at the 12th grade versus the kindergarten and the first grade, and the numbers are bigger. They're not bigger by much. I went through a population doing my search. I went through, about 20,000 people total over a mega area of several hundred miles. And I came up with a population growth in the schools of about 150 kids. But that's a growth. We haven't had a growth in South Dakota. The biggest census in South Dakota was in 1910, and it's been going down ever since. I honestly believe it has hit bottom, and it has turned, and it's coming up because people are fed up with congestion and crime. And they want to get someplace where they can let their kids go out and ride their bicycles and not worry about some molester around the corner. Well, that's the end of that speech.
That's a really good soapbox speech, though. I'm with you on almost all of it. And it's refreshing to see someone come in with an outside perspective who sees things with new eyes that people that have grown up in the area just kind of take for granted. You know, you mentioned in your email to me that people from New York don't ever go out to see the Statue of Liberty, and people in rural areas just don't appreciate the fine assets that are available to us. So I'm glad to have your outside perspective on that. Where can folks find you to stay in contact with you and to learn more about your book as well and upcoming books?
Well, the name of the book is Flyover County. It has a website. It's available on Amazon. I can be reached via email at flyovercounty@gmail.com. And send me a note there, and I can direct you. I can answer any questions you might want to know. And you're absolutely right. I've lived in major areas. People in New York City don't go to the Statue of Liberty. People who live in Washington, D.C. don't go to the top of the Washington Monument and look out those little windows. People from Iowa go and look out those little windows, and people from Nebraska will go and look up to the top of the Statue of Liberty, but people from New York will not take a Circle Line tour around the island of Manhattan. It's always there. But people, on the same token, people here don't know what they have. If I go to church on a Sunday morning and I take the time to look, and I don't anymore, I did when I first got here because I thought it was funny, more than 50% of the cars in the churchyard have the keys hanging in the ignition. And the cars are unlocked, and that's just something that's unheard of anywhere other than in rural America. You know, and of course, then you get the running joke, well, I always lock my car at church during the fall because I don't want the back seat filled with squash.
I'm afraid people will be too nice to me if I leave it open. I like it.
Exactly.
I like it. Well,
go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was just going to wrap up right there, Rick. I really appreciate you taking time to talk with us today to share some of your great stories of what you've learned about rural in your short time here, short being a relative term. And I appreciate you, I appreciate your very positive view and the fact that you share it.
Well, thank you. Again, I've been here for 10 years. I feel like I've been here my entire life. But at the same time, I feel like I got here yesterday because I keep tripping over things that are new and exciting. And I keep meeting. I've been here for 10 years. I've only met one person I didn't like. And he moved. So it doesn't matter. It's just a completely different way of looking at the world and of looking at things. And frankly, I think it's honest, it's fresh, and it's something that we should try to encourage the rest of the people in the country to be.
Well, very good. Thank you very much, Rick.
You have a wonderful afternoon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.